Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is Philip Lance, your host for today's episode. I'm an analyst in training at the Psychoanalytic Center of California, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Lewis Kirschner about his book, Intersubjectivity in Psychoanalysis, A Model for Theory and Practice, published by Routledge in 2017. Dr. Kirschner has worked as a Harvard professor and training psychoanalyst in Boston, and has been visiting professor in Lyon, France, and a Fulbright senior fellow in Ghent, Belgium. His numerous publications have treated developments in French psychoanalysis and the work of Lacan, Winnicott, and Ferenczi. His book, Having a Life, Self-Pathology After Lacan, was published in 2004, and he edited an anthology titled Between Winnicott and Lacan, A Clinical Engagement, published in 2014. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kirschner.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And let's just start with telling us about what led you to putting this book project together.
Well, I had been interested over the years, last 5 to 10 years, in this particular subject, and I was enjoying reading about it, and after my edited book came out, I was sort of thinking about what direction I was going to go in and thought of writing an article, and gradually I realized I had enough interdisciplinary interest that I could try to put together a book treating the concept of intersubjectivity in a broad way and trying to argue for its important role in psychoanalysis.
Okay, so the last 5 or 10 years, you've had a special interest in intersubjectivity. Where were you before that?
Well, I think This has been part, I think the people I was very interested in for a long time, Arnold Modell, a teacher of mine from Boston, certainly could be considered an early intersubjective thinker. And Jacques Lacan, as you mentioned, I'd done a lot of work on French psychoanalysis and Lacanian thought in particular. And of course, as I discuss in the book, he was really the first analyst to make intersubjectivity a very central part of the theory. So I think my interests were evolving in that direction. Yeah. But I was interested in also in the trying to integrate sort of a Lacanian structural linguistic approach with a more personal, more traditional psychoanalytic approach. So these ideas were swimming around for a while.
Okay. And you mentioned interdisciplinarity and a broad approach. Would you say this book is a broad interdisciplinary approach to subjectivity, or how would you describe?
I hope it is. I mean, I happen to have this curiosity and interest in looking to see what people in our neighboring disciplines have to say about the subjects that we as analysts are interested in, specifically disciplines like phenomenology, neuroscience, infant research, semiotics, and a lot of the people that are working in these areas cross paths in various ways. So it kind of made sense for me to try to sort out, what does this intersubjectivity, something that has a common meaning across these disciplines, can we work out kind of a more core definition of what it is? So those were questions on my mind when I started the book, which was over about 3 years ago, actually.
Yeah, it begins to show us what a broad sort of thing intersubjectivity is when we're bringing in neuroscience and infant research and philosophy. But then we could also go in the direction of the different schools of psychoanalysis and how we begin to look at them as intersubjective models or not. I can see how there's a broad territory we're beginning to look at. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell us a little about the overall sort of organization of the book, what it looks like in terms of its chapters and what it covers.
So the I try to give an overview in the introduction. It's a kind of a diverse kind of book. I wouldn't say it's tightly integrated, but I hope that by having a clinical orientation throughout, especially not in every chapter, but pretty much as I go along, I try to use clinical examples. I can kind of weave together these very abstract concepts with what psychoanalysts do and their practices. So there's a substantial chapter in the book that talks about what intersubjectivity means to the various disciplines. And that's maybe the knottiest chapter and maybe the one that is the most difficult and maybe the one I'm the least satisfied with. But I think I covered a lot of territory. I think it's an interesting chapter. And then I want to take up the concept, the role, place of affect and emotion in intersubjectivity. And so I do a rather lengthy review. I've always been interested in how psychoanalysis understands affect. And as you may know, Lacan is famous for having supposedly disparaged affect or dismissed affect as an important part of psychoanalysis. That's a point I challenged in my 2004 book. And some of the ideas from that book recur in my discussion of affect, but I tried to bring myself more up to date about emotion and affect research. And I have a perspective on these topics that is skeptical of reductionistic approaches, which seem to be gaining ground both in psychiatry and psychoanalysis and in neurosciences. That is, thinking you can explain something like emotion once you understand the biology of emotion and the connection between human emotion and other mammalian emotion, and areas that have been really important avenues of research in the last 10 or 15 years, but sometimes end up slighting the importance of emotion for communication and the way that emotion gets subjectivized, that it becomes a personal expression, not just a discharge of one of the core feelings from the midbrain. So I try to discuss controversies that have come up around that, and there's quite a bit. I mean, of course, if you go very deeply into any area of theory, you find everything is contested. And I try to review what some of those contested issues are for affect. So that was an important chapter. And I try to give some clinical examples of how affect plays a role in some of my own work. And then, of course, I, as you mentioned, the different theoretical schools. I don't mention all the schools, of course, but I do discuss how intersubjectivity has grown and played an increasing role in several schools in North American psychoanalysis. There's a intersubjective psychoanalysis that Robert Stolarow and his colleagues developed. And there are other important contributions, especially in the relational movement by Jessica Benjamin and Lewis Aaron. And there are others. So I try to review those. And then I take on some more of the issues that I think are very central to understanding intersubjectivity. That would include semiotics, and I try to have a chapter reviewing what that means and how it works for psychoanalysis. There have been important contributions in that area already. Bonnie Litowitz has contributed important articles in that regard. Janine Vivone, and there are others that I cite. And finally, I take on an old chestnut, which is, you know, the comparison of a human speaking subject to a text, the analogy to a text, which was a big issue maybe 40 years ago, and I kind of revisited it because I think it has some interesting facets to think about. It interests me anyway. And then in the end, I try to present a level that I call beyond semiosis. We can talk about that later, but it has to do with levels of a conception of interaction that are, you might say, more holistic than the semiotic approach, which tends to get fragmented into how we study the expression and reading of diverse kinds of signs, especially by human beings. So that's a mouthful. So that kind of covers the book. And along the way, there are a lot of, as I say, clinical vignettes, examples, extended cases, and so on that I hope are there, that they're mainly to illustrate what I mean and how I think about intersubjectivity.
Yeah, I felt like the earlier parts of the book, I'm hearing myself echoing right now and it's kind of bothering me, but I'll try to speak over my own voice. But I felt like the earlier parts of the books were almost reference-like in some ways of terrific literature reviews. It's something I'll want to go back to whenever if I'm ever writing something about intersubjectivity. But as the book went on, I felt like you started adding in more and more your own way you work with intersubjectivity and practice. And then there were some, I felt like, really original contributions, especially what you mentioned beyond semiosis. I'd like to get back to that if we have a chance. But let's begin more basically, because I don't know who really the listeners are to New Books in Psychoanalysis. Apparently, from what I can pick up, there's a broad range of people who are beginners to understand. Yeah, and they're all over the map. So maybe we can try to speak to all audiences and start with a really simple questions such as, you just wrote a book about this, but can you sort of boil down what is intersubjectivity in really simple terms?
Right. So I hope I haven't scared everyone off already by my convoluted answers. Intersubjectivity, how is it different from just interpersonal relatedness or relations? So you could say it's a kind of a refinement of the interpersonal concept, focusing on what goes on in the interaction between persons. And intersubjectivity talks about the interaction between two subjects. So it gets into more theoretical and clinical issues of how do we think of what a subject is? You know, when we think of what a person is, we tend to have a somewhat sociological idea of an individual who's fairly, in general, a discrete agent who has a particular set of qualities and, or we might say, of a character or personality and how he impacts others and they impact him or her. And that's certainly true. But when we look at sort of contemporary psychoanalytic theories of subjectivity and what it means to be a subject, then we get into more complicated ways of viewing what a person is. And we tend to question the idea that people are so coherent and cohesive that they have a kind of an identity that can be defined, or they have a personality that can be characterized usefully in the individual context. And there we look at it, subjectivity, as a more fluctuating set of different positions that a person moves across depending on the context they're operating in, especially the interpersonal or intersubjective context. So it offers a more contemporary postmodern, although that's already become a little bit overused and maybe bypassed now concept. But yeah, so but you'll see a lot of current psychoanalytic literature talking about subjectivity and different kinds of subjectivity, a lot of interesting discussions about that. And so intersubjectivity really is the theory of interaction, especially psychoanalytic interaction, since that's what we're talking about, that looks upon a human subject as a much more of an amalgam of different tendencies, structures, roles, positions, not a moving shape, you know, over time. I hope that helps.
I'm thinking myself, I'm always wondering, so when we begin hearing theorists who are using the word subject as opposed to person, I guess they're kind of beginning to work in this more contemporary idea. I'm trying to repeat, I guess, maybe what you said in my own words, but that people are not these kind of self-contained things, but that people are constituted by forces outside of themselves and are very much ongoing
works in progress.
to things that are outside them. And that complicates what psychoanalysis is about. And so, so then thinking about how that idea begins to change the program of psychoanalysis, I think you talk about intersubjectivity and psychoanalysis as expanding our subjectivity. So we're not trying to cure somebody or fix them necessarily, but there's something else going on. How do you talk about that aim of psychoanalysis in the intersubjective perspective?
Right. So, I don't think it's – I wouldn't say it's the only aim of psychoanalysis, but – because I think psychoanalysis is itself kind of an amalgam of different aspects, but for a long time we've become sensitized to the role of the analyst and the impact of the analyst on the patient, first in terms of countertransference, and then in terms of what the Argentinian analyst, the Béranger couple, talk about as the bipersonal field. And we have a whole explosion of field theories now that more or less look at that kind of phenomenon. So our interest in psychoanalysis has gradually shifted from figuring out what's going on, what the psychopathology is or the psychodynamics or whatever of a patient, to thinking about what's going on between the analyst and the patient. What's happening in the session? And how are we part of it? How are we shaping it? And so we're looking more and more in the present and the here and now, not in a disregard of the past, although I think that's one tendency in American psychoanalysis to kind of minimize the past. But if you view the past as emerging in different forms within the current interaction that either elicits, facilitates, enables, you know, expressions of the person's own history in the current interaction, then, you know, you really think of the work as not as a way of gaining access to a living past, how it comes to be in the current behavior and interaction of the patient in the context of the analysis. Of course, we hope that we believe, I think it depends. There are people that have a much more kind of field-dependent view of subjectivity as really very protean and almost infinitely malleable. And then there are other people that at the other end that would see the individual as a more stable configuration. I guess I'm kind of in the middle of that particular discussion. You know, I see the individual subject as rather changing and fluctuating, but I also see that there's something that in general is as a historical persistence. Not as a thing, as you say, but as a set of important reference points that kind of mark the boundaries of that particular subject. Although how far they mark them and how much they're subject to change, I guess we're we're kind of learning that as we move into this era where very few rigid boundaries of what constitutes our idea of how a person should function as a gender, as a person carrying aggression or drive forces, ability to relate, to belong to a group. All these things seem to be under a lot of rapid kind of process of change.
Yeah, and maybe this is a slight digression from where I thought I was going to go, but it's making me think about how training works, since I'm in training myself as a candidate. And, you know, and as I'm thinking about this kind of move in psychoanalysis from, could we say, the focus on the intrapsychic to the more and more to intersubjective ways of understanding what's happening in the consulting room. And yet my first 2 years of training have just been, and I love my institute, so I don't want to, get in trouble by criticizing it, but all we're reading is these really old school Freud and Klein it was hard for me being trained. Then I'm sitting with my clients constantly trying to discover the object relation dynamics that are the hidden, and I'm getting anxious because I can't find them. And as I've begun to study more intersubjective ways of looking at things, like more Bionian field theory, it's been quite a relief, and I found enjoying so much more my work. And it almost feels to me like training is backwards, that very new people to psychoanalysis, we need to right away begin to introduce them to some of these more contemporary ideas. And maybe then after they've got grounded in, they can go back and read these old papers. But any thoughts about
That's
training?
Very interesting. Well, you have your finger on what's going on in training now. I think when I trained, it was like the way you say, not so much in object relations, but in reading, classic papers, ego psychology, Freud. And they're very interesting papers still. People had some insights into human beings. I mean, a lot of the theory is kind of defunct, but there are still a lot of important insights about what goes on in analysis and analytic process in these papers. And it is our history. So I guess I have mixed feelings about it. I think we should know something about it. But I do think that there's a deficit in training of thinking about what does the analyst actually do? What does analysis accomplish? And I think when I trained, we didn't really know exactly. We thought we were supposed to resolve neurotic conflicts. We were supposed to bring unconscious fantasies into consciousness and then interpret them. And since I was not ever really doing that very well in my training, and I don't think anyone did it very well to me in my own experiences in analysis, I began to get disillusioned about that model. You wait forever for things to emerge and take shape. You're afraid to say anything because you're going to influence the process of treatment. I think we were really, throwing a curveball there that set analysis back a long way. And mm-hmm. I think we're still struggling with these ideas. Is it bad to be active as an analyst? What does it mean to be active? In what ways can you be active? What are the effects of your activity? It's an interactive process. So if it's fundamentally that, how do we study that? How do we learn about that? And I try to talk about that a bit at the end of the book, but it really needs a whole study about training. I agree with you. And hopefully, I think now when cases are presented, I hope there's more attention to, how the analyst presents the case illustrates their countertransference, and we should be able to talk about that comfortably. It's nothing embarrassing, You have to be in a situation of trust reasonably to be able to undertake that kind of exploration. If you feel you're being judged in a class or you're going to look stupid, you don't dare. But a class ought to strive for a kind of openness, and I think the instructor can model that. I've always said that this is going off on a little bit of a tangent, but maybe it's related. I think I don't know what it's like now for you. You're in a very good institute, but how often do the instructors present cases of their own that people discuss in the class and expose their work? Not nearly enough. And I think just doing that would demystify a lot of things for candidates. You know, it's not like the instructors have some wisdom where they know how to make these brilliant formulations and deliver them to the patient. Or if they think they can, usually the class is going to poke a lot of holes in it pretty rapidly, you know, because, you know, most people who are candidates have some, enough experience to, you know, have some sense about, you know, how to look at possibilities of what's going on in their infinite ones, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for letting me vent on that a little bit. I could pick up from your question on what do the instructors do, but I'm going to try to get back to your book and to intersubjectivity, maybe 101, one last little question. Maybe it's not a little question, but when I first started reading, I read some Jessica Benjamin several years ago, and within the first few paragraphs, there was something about Hegel, and my sort of heart dropped, and I thought, oh my gosh, am I going to have to understand and study Hegel in order to read psychoanalysis? And so but then when reading your book, you touch on the famous Hegel master-slave parable. And that comes up often in other discussions of intersubjectivity in other schools. And I'm still not sure I quite get that. And can you tell us what your take is on what that parable means about intersubjectivity?
Well, it's become kind of a core kind of a set of images and metaphors for, you know, a lot of things about human beings. And Jacques Lacan was the first analyst, as far as I know, to make this into a part of his theory and to talk about it a lot. And then Arnold Model in the United States talked about it, and Jessica Benjamin, of course, wrote about it quite a bit. And it comes out of it's part of a philosophical tradition that tried to deal with what it means to use the word subject, what a subject is, what is a human subject. And Hegel's work was partly an extended parable about how a person becomes a subject, or there's a historical process of becoming and so on. And it weaves its way into phenomenology and modern philosophy. And part of his thick book, you know, on the phenomenology of the spirit, spirit being kind of what you might call mind or soul or whatever, metaphor of works for what we're, this idea. You know, he imagines a mythic encounter between two subjects and it's a pure parable. But some people draw some historical roots and meanings from it. excuse me. So in this encounter, it's like one subject suddenly meets another one. And Model talks about this very nicely, I think. You know, when there's an encounter between two subjects, there's always a threat. This other subject can affirm you for who you want to be, can affirm your identity and sense of self, but they can also disaffirm it. They can disqualify you, and they can cause injury, hurt, or even maybe a more powerful effect of kind of destroying your sense of who you are as a subject, or at least reduce it to something lesser. And so that's an interesting idea in itself. And it is kind of a metaphor for a lot of human interaction. I mean, it's not all love and sweetness and light. I mean, there's the other person's a threat, as well as a possible source of love and reassurance and affirmation. So how does that threat get negotiated? How does it get handled? I use the analogy I borrowed from somewhere of if you've ever been hiking alone, and I enjoy hiking, you know, usually you're with somebody, but if you ever hike alone, have you ever sort of arrived at a point where you're looking out a vantage point at a beautiful vista and you feel at one with the world, you feel very powerful and elated and expanded in some sort of basic, you know, way. And then all of a sudden, a couple people noisily enter a scene, right, you know, from the woods, from the trail. And all of a sudden, everything changes. They're seeing you, you're seeing them. They're intruding on you. You resent them. You're going to, all of a sudden, your sense of who you are shrinks a little bit. What are they going to think of you? Who are these hikers? What do you think of them? You, on the other hand, you might enjoy their presence and talk about it. It might shift into something different in a good way, but you don't initially usually welcome them. It changes the whole scene. And so that's kind of a pragmatic, to me, illustration of this kind of Hegelian encounter in a more benign form. And of course, Hegel thought what he writes about is how one person, each subject wants to get the other person to affirm them. So there's kind of a contest. Who's going to give in? And that's basically who's going to become the master? Who's going to become the other's slave? And because it's an all-important struggle in this confrontation, with everything being at stake in the end, there's a threat of violence. There's a threat of it leading to a contest for life or death between the two people. Who's going to predominate and be the master? So Hegel imagines a whole sequence of things that happen. You know, one person gives in and becomes the slave to the other, and then the other person is installed as the master and so on. And but over time, of course, the master then realizes that he is dependent more and more on the slave to give him the affirmation he craves. The other person becomes more important, and the slave begins realizing that in working for the master, it has some power over the situation. So then there's a whole further set of steps. Anyway, this is kind of an outline of it. Jessica Benjamin deals with it beautifully, I think, in her first book, and Lacan talked about it in evocative ways before that. So if you have a philosophical, imaginative curiosity, the parable might be appealing, you know. But even at its most simple level, you know, how do two subjects, like an analyst and an analysant, deal with each other? How do they come to not have a clash of power? How is the negative transference not predominate over the positive transference, you know? And a lot of times, every analysis, you know, there's got to be some negative transference. The analyst has to be a bit of a threat, and it can be in the form of resistance, and the analyst may try to break the resistance. The analyst may perpetuate the resistance or the conflict, and it can go on a long time, years in some cases, you know. You know, you may, okay, in the literature, that, yeah.
That was very helpful to me, and it helps me, connects back to your idea about expanding subjectivity. In other words, when we come into these encounters with the other, and sometimes problematic authoritarian ones, a master and a slave, how we work through that together, the problems that come up in that encounter, then can lead to a lot of growth, I guess, in both parties, hopefully especially the patient. So let's kind of move on a little bit, because early on you mentioned infant research, mm-hmm. Neuroscience. And, you know, my institute talks a lot about infant observation, but they never used, in seminars, the word intersubjectivity doesn't come up. Infant observation is very much about, I guess, trying to sort of see the object relations that are developing between the infant and its mother. So it's kind of that focus on infant observation. But you reference it as an important informative practice to intersubjectivity. Can you say how?
Yeah, well, we, you know, at my institute about 15 years ago, when Daniel Stern was alive and working, maybe it was more than 15, I don't know. We had a program where we called it the psychoanalytic infant. And we had five people present the view of infancy from their own particular school, Kleinian school, Freudian school, relational school, Lacanian school. It was almost humorous, you know, how different everybody had their own infant, that, which is their imaginary infant, which is how your ideas, the images you have from your theory about how people are, organize your perception and understanding. And, but, you know, I think the, I'm surprised that you haven't heard that term, because one of the nicest books about intersubjectivity is Beatrice Beebe and her group's book called Forms of Intersubjectivity. She's an infant researcher. One of the sources of the term intersubjectivity comes from infant research, comes from Colin Trevarthen. This is, I don't know, 20 years ago or more. And he talked about what goes on between the infant and the mother as an example of what he called primary intersubjectivity. And maybe he adopted the term from philosophy, from phenomenology, I'm not sure. But what he talked about was that the interaction between infant and mother is not just like the Freudian infant having drives and survival instincts and attachment, you know, not attachment, but need satisfaction and pleasure from sucking and so on, or the Kleinian one where these fantasies of incorporation and expulsion and projection, but that the infant and the mother represent two subjects and they're communicating with each other. They're negotiating. They're trying to work out a relationship. That was, I think, Trevarthen's very groundbreaking perception. And I think that the work of theorists like Daniel Stern, Beatrice Beebe, pursued the development of those kind of ideas of Trevarthen. Of course, different infant researchers use the concept of intersubjectivity differently. It's interpreted a bit differently, but still, I think it has become a very important idea that the infant is an active agent shaping the encounter. And then that has begun to be applied increasingly to the analytic encounter. The Boston Process of Change group that I refer to a bit in my book, that was Daniel Stern's group with Ed Tronick and Alex Harrison and others in the beginning, they, you know, definitely took the findings of infant research in that respect and tried to apply them to the adult-to-adult analytic interaction. And in the relational school, it's very prevalent that you hear those kind of analogies. So it has become an important source of ideas for psychoanalysts to try to apply what they've learned from infant research. I mean, it's maybe over-applied in my view, or it isn't to me a totally satisfactory model, but it's a useful heuristic or model for thinking about adult interaction. Yeah, so infant research definitely has an important place in this whole panorama of intersubjectivity. Yeah.
We could go on because I could say more about, I guess at my institute, they're so experientially, they really send us out to do the infant observation and then to come back and talk about the experience. It's really not dealt with theoretically much at all, but to the degree it is, it seems like it's the infant's experience with the mother, how that shapes the intrapsychic, the unconscious of the infant. So we're still in that old paradigm, even though obviously the infant's mind is being shaped very much by how it's handled by the mother physically.
In every way, but of course, when you observe the infant, you have reactions, you know. And partly they're your own reactions, of course, but, you know, from your own history, but partly they're what you're reading in the infant, you know, and if you are interacting with the infant, the fact that you have certain reactions to them. I mean, if they're screaming, you might feel compassion. You might want to pick the infant up. You might get frustrated and impatient. You know, you might have all kinds of different reactions. And clearly the way you interact is either going to soothe the infant or modify the infant's behavior or get you into a worse impasse, just like with your own real infant, you know. I mean, you know, raising an infant, I mean, there are times where you are impatient and frustrated with the creature. You just can't stand it. You want to go back to sleep and you hate the kid. And, you know, and that doesn't work too well. It leads to, you know, maybe it's very hard to soothe a child when you're feeling all this rage back. You know, you have to kind of work out a different way. And it isn't just a matter of physical techniques. You know, everything has its place. So, yeah, I think probably maybe you could inflect the discussion in that respect, because I think a lot of people do use infant research to teach some fundamentals of intersubjectivity. Because when you try to think what's going on in the infant's mind, well, there, you know, your guess is as good as mine. You know, Melanie Klein's guess is as good as Robert Stolaro's or Heinz Kohut or Arnold Modell or Andre Green. You know, you get a dozen theories. They're all very well articulated. And there are interesting ways to think about people, no doubt about that. They may be useful, but don't think you've understood really what's going on in the mind of the infant or another person. That's how I feel about those matters, you know. I think you have to be careful with theory. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and kind of illustrate how broad the territory is we're talking about. We go from infant research. I want to go to one of your final chapters where you talk about the patient as a text. So we're going from how babies and mommies are being together to this whole other idea of how people, subjects can be looked at textually. And I really liked how you kind of did a review there of that idea and came up with sort of a qualified way of looking at it. But do you want to say any more about how you handled that?
Well, it's a subject that interested me. You know, it was a kind of a big issue a long time ago, maybe 30 or more years ago, especially in literary studies and in philosophy and part of structuralist theory. You know, that was the dominant paradigm back then. I enjoyed taking it up again and playing with it to think about the structuralist idea that a person can be analogized to a text that they've been kind of programmed in a certain way by their social milieu and the context they were raised in to you know, emit certain kinds of answers and signifiers and identify with. It doesn't correspond to this actively changing, interacting idea of a subject. And so I wanted to play with that idea, which was kind of part of my own history. And I liked the metaphor of the person. You know, there's something textual about a person in that we all have only a certain repertoire of words and ideas, collections of words, references that we use when we think and speak. And you could say those form a certain kind of text that we that constitutes us, that determines our self-expression. But at the same time, I try to argue against that we're also open systems, that we're always incorporating new information. We're interacting with the people that we're communicating our textualized messages to, and we're changing. And so I talk about a text. This was a Lacanian kind of metaphor, a text that keeps being written. You know, we're not a finished text. And sometimes I feel in psychoanalysis, more traditional psychoanalysis, we tend to think of the person as a written text, something that can be analyzed and we can see how it works, you know. So I like the idea of an open text that keeps evolving and changing. Things drop out, things get added. But it's a little bit, yeah, it's a, for me, a kind of enjoyable chapter. And I know there are some people who I've had as readers who really like that, enjoyed playing with those ideas. Other people just skipped over it because it's, you know, very abstract and so on.
Well, yeah, I somehow really liked, I felt like you dealt with it very unabstractly somehow. And I'll read a little line that I liked from that chapter. You said, rather than functioning as the reader of a text, the analyst might be more usefully viewed as supporting the conditions for an ongoing process of writing one. So not a reader of a text, but the analyst is helping the patient write one. Or yeah. So anyway, let's move on, though.
That's a good thing.
Or do you want to say it?
And that gets along with my idea about how the function of the analyst that I highlight in this book, as I say, I don't think it's the sole function, but it's to help the patient to expand their subjectivity, to include more symbols and signs and images that constitute who they are. You could say to make more of the unconscious conscious, but it's really a question of expanding the speaking part of the person, so that it incorporates more of their own history, more of their own feelings and wishes. And we know when we sit down with a patient the first time, we often get a narrative, we get a kind of a limited presentation of who the person is. We get some fairly rigid views about some of their relationships and some other feelings about important others. And we hope that over time, those feelings and ideas are going to become much richer and deeper and more complicated, so that their previous kind of formulations about who they are and what's going on in their relationships grow. They become more diverse, and the person has more options and choices for how they function, how they behave and interact. So that's kind of my message in a nutshell. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I don't think we're going to get to the discussion about beyond semiotics, which is in chapter 8, but I'll just say I found that really, although it sounds abstract, beyond semiotics, it was actually a really grounding kind of chapter where we came back to what it's like being and what, how.
Yeah. Well, you asked me a question about that and how is it different. And what I think is that, you know, semiotics is the correct way to understand human interaction. But it's hard to grasp the concept of a subject, of a whole in quotes, you know, of an interacting subject, a human being, just in the details of semiotics. I think we need concepts that are broader, and I try to talk about that in that chapter. That's really where I should, you know, really what needs to be developed if I continue to develop in that direction.
Okay, and then what are you working on in terms of maybe another book?
Yeah, I've been very interested in this question of consciousness and unconsciousness. What is the unconscious? And of course, consciousness is very important, essential for psychoanalysis. And I think it's essential for being a subject and for being a speaking semiotic subject. So how to carry that a little further, you know? So I've been reading more about what, you know, in terms of my interdisciplinary interests, especially in current phenomenology and cognitive science. How do they think about consciousness, and why don't they incorporate our psychoanalytic experience of the unconscious? Well, it's partly because we're pretty confused and we're using an amalgam of ideas, some way out of date, some, you know, so that it needs an update. So that a lot of people are working in that area, and that's where I'd like to go in the future. So it's an extension maybe of that last chapter.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, we're out of time. And so thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about your book, which, and so let me tell the listeners, you've been listening to an interview with Lewis Kirschner about his book. Let me go back to the title, Intersubjectivity in Psychoanalysis, A Model for Theory and Practice. here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis podcast show. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and visit our website, where you can find dozens and dozens of interviews from the past. And feel free to email me with your comments and questions. So thank you again, Dr. Kirshner.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you. Good experience. You know, we covered a lot of territory.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.